Maybe we get to ask questions.
No, he has one back there.
Martha, ask somebody a question.
No, there's a guy back there.
On? Yes. Okay. You had said a line about balls and the beads, the rosary beads. I thought that was hilarious because I never compared those two together. So I'm anxious to know, how did you come up with that, or do you have a story behind that?
Well, I mean, you know, in a lot of ethnic neighborhoods, the guys on the corner, right, playing with them, with their junk. And then you see the priests from those same neighborhoods. When they're priests, what do they do in their pocket? They're probably, we hope they're not playing with their junk, but you know, they're doing their beads. And, but it's the same gesture, if you've ever seen them. They're standing there like this on a corner. You know, 20 years late, 10 years later, you know, when they, one of them becomes a priest. Yeah.
After all that training.
After it's that training, it's that, you know, it, yeah.
There's a comment on that, Paul. During the Second World War.
It's working.
Okay, well, okay. During the Second World War, Bernard Berenson, who kept those diaries during his exile from his home in Florence, said one of the problems with the American airmen who were hiding out in Italy, and they were being housed by Italian families at great risk, is they would walk around jingling the change in their pockets.
Okay,
so there's a history to this.
And, yeah, that's another one. But that's a different neighborhood.
It was a different neighborhood.
Yeah, it's a different neighborhood. Nobody does that anymore.
I'm going to go right there.
This is about geography, Paul, because Paul was born in North Beach, right above North Beach Liquors. The building's still there. And he moved to, some of us came north and we never left, but he went south and he never came back, except he's here tonight. And Martha, of course, maybe you could comment too, but the geography of Los Angeles and what brought you there and kept you there and that kind of thing, you know.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let Martha.
You got it. Martha first. No. Oh, we don't need that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, we don't need it. It might just be a sentence. I don't know. Maybe.
I came because I was married at the time to a man who got a job at CalArts, which opened in Los Angeles. And then I was a single mother with a child, and I got a job. And when you have a job, you often stay there because that pays your rent. So I stayed there.
Yeah. I had signed in 1968. I came back from, I went to grad school in Ireland for a year, but ran out of money, and I was a draft resister. I refused induction, and I had to go to grad school overseas because here my dean at my college, I remember his words, refused to write a recommendation for any fellowship. He said, the only thing I'll be glad to recommend you for is the Army, right? This is 1967 Vietnam, right? Okay, so I went abroad and I came back and I signed a contract out here at Holy Name Parish to teach sixth grade. Never told you this. You imagine me teaching sixth grade. Anyway, to teach sixth grade because it was a job, right? And then out of the blue, USC took me on as a graduate student and a professor, you know, assistant professorship. So I had a free ride, and similar reason. Went to LA to make a living, and then got a job, and then a job, and still in LA.
Yeah.
Though it is a fascinating place.
Yeah. Well, I too went to USC for my undergrad, so fight on. So this was the question that I'm going to have. It was originally inspired by Martha's work, but you also talked about it as well, Paul. And it's this idea of time and how it's captured in still moments or still pieces, and how those persist through time. One of the images, Martha, that you talked about was like the blurry photograph, and that reminded me of this. There's this really famous poem of a dog walking, and its feet are very blurry, and it's about how like the fourth dimension of time permeated painting. So I was just wondering if you could both talk about, maybe Martha, you can talk a little bit about photographs as well, about how they persist through time and how your poems persist through time. Do they help time pass? Do they freeze time? Is it a little bit of both? And sort of how art that is like this is interacting with time as it continuously moves forward. Does that make sense as a question? Okay.
You start with time in the photographs. You're eloquent about that.
Yeah, I guess with thinking just about what I read in terms of time in photographs, it was that that sense that it's especially in those black and white 19th century ones, you get a sense of a moment that's been captured and that's passed, and that you can't get to it. And so that, I think Bart's right, you're always being reminded of mortality of various sorts. I think for me anyway, in terms of writing poetry, one of the things that I have to fight against is that when I sit to read, there's a way in which memory gets opened up, and trying to, and so I have spent much of my time writing being inundated by memories I didn't know I had, and I would like not to do that. But it's a kind of struggle, I think, to figure out how, when you are in the space in which you're writing poetry, not to get overwhelmed by your own history, and to do something else. And it's not a tension that I've been able to, or a struggle that I've been able to win, really. I keep losing. But I do think it's one needs to engage in, because it's just so tempting when they're sitting there on top of your shoulders to not deal with them in some way. But I don't know. And the other thing is, as you get older, there's a way in which the preciousness of time is so palpable, and the way in which you want to hold on to certain things and write about certain things, and it focuses certain things in a way that are less dramatic. I don't know how to say it exactly, but things that are much more quotidian, much more ordinary. And I know that when I was young, things that were much more cataclysmic and dramatic and heartbreaking were the things that drew me. And I now find the preciousness of smaller things more salient in some way. Not that I don't think that, I think getting older is tragic in its own way, but it's those little things somehow. But.
I you made me think about a phrase that it's first in the Thelonious Monk poem, and then it's repeated three or four times in the last piece. The notion, as I get older, I'm here there. All the time. I'm not here, I'm not there, I'm here there, which is another way to say what Martha's saying. I'm here there. And LA is the perfect place to be here there. You know, if there's no there in Oakland, right, as Gertrude Stein said, there's no here in LA, you know. There's no here here. So, anyway, has to do with time. Time is really, you're from LA, time is a really strange thing in LA. It feels a lot different than here or somewhere else.
So, Paul, would you agree with Ezra Pound that time is the destroyer?
Mm-hmm. Time is the evil. Evil. That's from Canto number 31. Time is the evil. Evil.
Can you explain that? A little.
Well, Martha said it really well. It takes away tragedy. It makes even the tragic sort of no longer tragic. I mean, the only thing I feel that saves me now is I just laugh my ass off all the time. I can't. I cry and I laugh. There's nothing in between for me anymore. But I don't cry over necessarily. I cry over beautiful things, and I laugh all the time to myself. This is all alone. I try not to do it in public. I'm already thought to be feeble enough. But yeah, I can't. It's become so ridiculous, and I think Pound is getting at that, where no matter how serious you are, time just takes it away. Time is the evil, period. Evil, period. That's a line from his great poem, The Contest.
I have to think about that. But anyway.
Anybody else with a question?
Yeah, you know, but Alan says, what thou lovest will remain.
The rest is dross.
So, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of time. He said, and so I've always held on to that he says that, and that he Pound. Oh, thank you. Something to hold. Sort of, so what about that? What thou lovest well remains, and that's a pretty important.
What do you think?
Stick of dynamite. Just that, you know. I mean, I think he's saying that there's something permanent, and that's...
When does he say that?
Well, it's in the Peas and Cantos.
Yeah, he said it in a cage.
He said it in 1944, probably.
Five.
45, okay.
He's in a cage.
Yeah. It's in the cage in Pisa, yeah.
Yeah, and the other one, he said it in 1930-something, and he's got two women that love him. He's got two families, I mean, are all whatever, and it's all very strange, and he's sort of at the height of his powers. And he says time is evil, and the other one, I don't know. I mean, I believe him. The line is, what thou lovest well remains, the rest is dross.
Lovest well shall not be reft from thee.
You know, that's the whole thing about pulling from thy vanity and all that. But yeah, does it mean, is he assuming that what he's doing is going to remain? I'm not sure.
Well, I think he's trying to make up for his complicity in what had just come down, and he knows I'm in a cage, and I've got to. But I think I just like that idea that he held on to something permanent.
Yeah.
And even in the end, and even in Drafts and Fragments, he has these drips and drops of affirmation.
Right.
That in a way you'd have to say are really based on time. You know?
Yeah.
Let the wind speak.
Yeah, let
that is paradise.
That is paradise.
Yeah.
There is no paradise beyond this one.
Right. Then you can tackle Eliot if you want. Time present. How does that go?
Eliot's a firm believer.
Yeah. He's a believer.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
So it makes a difference.
It makes a difference, yeah. Yeah.
So you've mentioned the ways that you mentioned some of the themes that you both like to tackle, the melancholy, noticeably some of your poems were memorials and ways to remember. What are some ways that you both like to tackle form to enhance your themes?
You answer that.
Yeah, she always thinks I guess I'm more formal. You know, I, in teaching, in the MFA teaching I've done, and I'm retiring this year, you know, we argue back and forth about content mattering at all, you know, and I'm trying to hold on to a tougher formal line. I don't know, but to me, you know, music is really important to me, especially jazz and 18th century music, 17th, 18th. I'm not, after that, I'm not as big on so-called Western art music, me jazz, you know. Anyway, and one of the things that is important to me in jazz is that it's about what you do with the song, not necessarily the song. It's about what you do with it, and that's the thing that pushes me. I'm not saying there is no content in jazz, you know. God knows, there is, and it's very complicated, and has to do with everything, you know, and I mean everything that the people who played it went through, you know. But I think there is a hard line, and that hard line has to do with how you put the thing together, how you put the music together, how you put the words together, and to me that's what keeps me going. I know there's form, and I know there's content, and this last thing I wrote is full of content, but that's on purpose in a certain sense. It's all the kind of stuff that I was avoiding for 20 years writing about, you know. But it's there. You don't see it. It looks like prose, except the part with the rosary, you know, and the balls. That's part thinking back on my, you know, I'm first generation and thinking back on immigrants and immigrant culture. That's in poetry. And there's particular folk songs I have in mind there that are in the background. But the other two parts look like prose, but there are rhymes all over.
Yeah,
in certain places.
You know, I think that's part of it, I think, is the way in which, and Paul does this a lot, where he hides a kind of structure. He'll take and do something very structured and then sort of move it around. But I still think, even for people who are doing much freer kinds of verse, the importance of sound is always there. You know, the ways in which words sound against each other and the way they repeat back and forth, and the use of certain kinds of refrains or certain kinds of words that come back at the beginning or ending of lines. And I do think it's always important to read things out loud and to hear how it is that you're reading something and how something sounds. The other struggle, and I think everybody who tries to write thinks about this too, is how you use space on a page and whether you can assume that there's silence in that space or not, and how you lay it out, and you know, that's something that goes back and forth with people. I think even an individual, I have arguments with myself about, can you do that, and what does it mean, and how especially since I've been trying to write about silence, how in the world do you get silence into into a poem? And so that's why I went back to read Wallace Stevens, because he does it. I think he does it really well. Mm. So, I don't know. My sense is one of the best things we can do is go back and read the people that we admire and try to understand why we admire them, and what we can do about standing near them in some way.
But. Yeah, you might look at the work. She stopped writing effectively in the late 30s, early 40s. But you might look at the work who picks up this idea of, does poetry mean anything, or is it sound, or whatever? And I think she does it masterfully. She didn't write that much, but I think she's great. Laura Writing, look, one of my real heroes. Look up. And there's a poem called "Poet That Lying Word." Very fine poem. An amazing sound display, you know.
Do you consider any of your work as exfractic?
Say it again.
Do you consider any of your work exfractic?
Exfrastic?
Yeah.
Yes, I do, and because particularly some I've been writing lately that are based on paintings. So the ones that are on photography are partly that way, but I have some recent ones that are you know, focused on. I did one on a Poussin painting, and I like doing those. I think there's a way in which, and I should say, this is a kind of confession, I guess, but as an academic, I taught Shakespeare, and one of the things that I spent a lot of time doing was to write about Shakespeare's use of emblems in his plays. So it was kind of a examination of his minimal kind of ekphrastic use of portraits of characters, when the character sort of stops on stage and then you get a description that's a kind of, there's no dialogue really going on, not much is happening between characters, and you get a moment, which happens most vividly, I think, in Twelfth Night, when Viola talks about, I had a sister who sat like Patience on a monument. And Patience on a monument was actually a woodcut in a emblem book in the 15th century. So I think I've always been interested in, I think, in artworks of various kinds. And again, sometimes I wish I weren't, but you know, one finds that one's interested in what one's interested in, and you have to sort of, you have to go with it, whatever that happens to be. And I do think one of the wonderful things about writing poetry is that you sort of find out what you care about. It, you sit there long enough in your chair meditating on language, and you you think, oh, yes, it's really true. That painting comes back to you over and over again. It matters to you. And sometimes you don't even know what things matter to you, or the kids on the corner, or the way your uncle talked to you, or you know, some social problem. I mean, I don't write about social problems, and there I am writing about wages, and I don't know. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
You've been a great audience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Attentive. You pay attention. Gee whiz. I'd love to know what everybody else is doing.